This program is part of Full Service Radio, an internet radio station and podcast network with over 32 weekly shows broadcasting from the lobby of the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. All of our hosts are Washington, D.C. locals, covering stuff like music, arts, culture, identity, politics, and so much more. Visit fullserviceradio.org for all of our programming and enjoy the show. And Full Service Radio is also proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
This is Nikki Nellis. You know me from the list, areyouonit.com, and my show, Foodie and the Beast, that I co-host with my husband, David Nellis. We have been on air as Foodie and the Beast for the last 9 years, covering the DC food and wine scene, talking to absolutely everybody about what's hot, what's good, and what's delicious. And we are so lucky to be here in this
super... And
what's
controversial,
too. Oh, yes. A little controversy is
always fun. I like
that
part. That's my part.
We're here in the super chic Line Hotel that just opened recently, where they have a radio station for all to see right when you walk into the hotel. And we are so lucky to start our first show, Industry Night, with Foodie, that's me, and
the Beast.
The Beast, my husband David. and this show is going to be a little different than Foodie and the Beast. Foodie and the Beast is like a rockin' party, usually. We have lots of segments. We go super, super fast. And we're so fortunate that we get to be on this show here, and we get to really get in depth with the people that we know about some of the biggest topics going on in the food world. Some of it will be local, and some of it will be national or international.
We always have a drink segment, which is the most important part.
We feel that booze is really important.
Booze is important.
It's important to the food and wine scene. Did I miss anything about what we're doing?
I think so. I mean, this show is more of our other show is like a variety show.
Yes.
This is more of a deep dive into substantive subjects related to what we eat, how we eat, why we should eat that way.
But we're not going to be boring.
No, it's not boring. It's not with me on the air.
Yeah, right. You're
real,
never boring,
get
honey.
Real, girlfriend.
Right. So, you want to introduce today's guest?
Sure,
you want to start the process?
One of our guests tonight is Brian McNair. He's the executive director of World Central Kitchen, Jose Andres' amazing operation that's really global. And they're focused... Good evening, Brian.
Good evening. You got me there.
I don't know why you're saying good evening. I've been with you for the last 2 hours.
I know, but that's okay. I know.
But World Central Kitchen is into really serious matters related to feeding and caring for people in need around the world when governments can't or don't or won't. And we're going to talk about how it's done. And
I think what's really important when we start with Brian is talking about where it started and where it is now, because obviously Jose has been in the news and World Central Kitchen has been in the news an awful lot with everything they've been doing in the past 6 months. And I'm really looking forward.
Right?
Yeah. And California and Harvey. So I'm really looking forward to understanding how they went from point A to point Z.
But first,
we're going to have a little
but
fun.
But first... An old friend of ours from Foodie and the Beast, Chris Houck, who is, I want to get this right, you're the Moët Hennessy Portfolio Specialist, right?
That's
and
correct.
And he's brought his friend Jeffrey Berriantos, who is his colleague, who is the champagne specialist for Moët Hennessy.
And who actually kind of knows Jose, since you were at the mini bar for long time.
True. Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes, I was the general manager at
If
Minibar.
You knew yes. Jose like I know.
Okay, anyway, move on. All right, so gentlemen, let's talk about Moët.
Sounds good
to
me.
Well, I got a question. Not a question, but, you know, it is possible that someone listening really doesn't understand the difference between champagne and sparkling wines and all that. Champagne comes from a very specific region, a wine-growing region in France, correct?
Look what
That's
you
correct.
Know. Good for you.
Oh, my God. Being patronized so early in the show.
Okay, so give us the rundown. Champagne versus sparkling.
Champagne is a wine that's been grown, vinified, and fermented, and aged in Champagne region.
Mm-hmm.
And using the secondary fermentation process.
I've been vilified, but never vinified.
But for people who don't understand, why is that champagne and what they grow in California or Spain or Italy not champagne?
Prosecco is from Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Cava is from Spain.
Right.
And Prosecco does not use the same secondary fermentation method.
Mm-hmm.
Cava does usually. But with champagne, it's got to be from Champagne. It has to be made from...
Champagne, France.
Yes.
For those has who to be don't made know. From...
Oh, look what you know.
I just want to be clear.
Wow.
So smart.
Right.
So it has to be made from usually primarily one of three main grapes. In Champagne, you're actually allowed to have up to seven grapes total.
Mm-hmm.
But the primary three are Chardonnay, Meunier, and Pinot Noir.
And so what is the effect of the difference of grapes? Like what are... like. You're going to pour a Moët, not Moët, Moët.
Correct,
Chandon.
Moët.
So what is the mix of grapes in that, and what is the flavor profile of it?
This is about 30 to 40% Pinot Noir, 30 to 40% Meunier, about mm-hmm. 10 to 20 Chard.
Okay, Chardonnay.
Yes.
No, if you're cool, you say Chard.
No, but, you
excuse
know,
me, Chardonnay.
No, Chris, you're cool.
Right, get with the lingo, totally get it. And is that just the classic Moët Chandon? Those are the way it works?
That is the classic. As a matter of fact, those proportions, about 20 to 30% are Chardonnay, but those proportions are about almost perfectly reflective of the Champagne region's grapes
okay.
in general. In all of Champagne, it's about a third, a third, a third for those three primary grapes.
Well, let me ask you both a question since, Jeffrey, you're the specialist of Champagne. Maybe you can answer this. So Cava does the second fermentation. But the cavas that people are pouring, at least in this region, I find to be incredibly sweet. Is that because they think the American palate wants sweet? Because I don't feel that cava is really reflective of champagne, other than the bubbles.
Yeah, no, that's an accurate assessment. You know, you have wines that are being made in the European market for the U.S. palate or North American palate. So you'll have those possibilities, especially with the wines in Prosecco too. But you know,
Prosecco, like I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, would drink Prosecco and really enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I can't anymore. It's every time I take a sip of Prosecco, I'm like, this is gonna make me sick later. Like it's just the sugar residuals in it are just so high.
Well, you know, I think there's this trend growing where everyone is getting drier. It's happening slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Champagne as well, as you're saying, drier styles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more terroir, more mineral and earth driven styles. So the wines are becoming more interesting and more complex, and you know, more minimalist and being left to their own devices. Yeah.
Do you think the Champagne region is doing that because people are really seeing it more as a wine instead of just a celebratory drink? Like it's something that can really be used to complement a meal.
Absolutely.
Am I giving your lines away?
No,
have I
you
taken
did.
It from you?
It's great. No, you understand it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the direction it's going. And I see that there's other styles happening. You know, people get bored. You know, there needs to be new things, and you know, there's. It's okay to have a little bit of sugar, residual sugar in the wines. Now, you know, that was never there to make the wines very, very dry. It was always there to sort of round out the palate and, you know, make the wines a little bit more palatable, less tart and less austere.
Well, let's explain to people because there are different categories of champagne, right? You got the Brut and the Reserve. Can you just break it down for everybody so that they understand what it is or how it works?
Yes. You're talking about when you're talking about champagne.
Let's pop that champagne.
when you're talking about champagne,
mm-hmm. and the anticipation
and the different levels.
I'm waiting for the pop.
I know.
Here you go.
Do the pop.
Oh, come on. Woo!
There it is.
There we go. Now the party can start.
The dosage is the level of sugar that a champagne has that they use at the very end of the process.
Uh-huh.
So
dosage is a really like industry insider term. Do you know what I mean? Like I was at a champagne event.
Does that mean dosage?
In English, yes.
Yeah.
In French, it's dosage.
You guys, what a bunch of effete, impudent snobs, boy.
But I just, I was at a champagne event. It was DC Champagne Week, and I went to this fabulous event with Mrs. Jamais from New York, and everybody was using that term, and I was like, where have I been? Why don't I know dosage? So can you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. With champagne, we vinify each of the grapes separately.
Mm-hmm.
Then they go into a blend.
Mm-hmm.
Once that blend has been accepted by the head winemaker and the rest of the winemaking team, the wine then goes into the bottle with a little bit of sugar, a little bit of yeast, and a little bit more wine.
Mm-hmm.
That then starts the secondary fermentation process. So put a cap on it, it sits. There's your secondary fermentation. That's where the bubbles come from in champagne.
You will notice that I haven't said a word except to make a couple of stupid statements. Because
I
you
apologize.
Guys,
I'm
you
hogging
guys,
the
you
mic.
You guys lost me at champagne. But now that you've poured
it. Wasn't it wasn't dosage.
I want to get. No, it was you. You lost me there. All right. I want to start talking to Brian. Because, but first of all.
Dosage.
Can we just. Brian, wait. Can we
don't start speaking French. Let's do a toast.
David,
that's
can we just
say. Wants to do.
Congratulations. She wants to do. Thank you all for joining
Thank
us
you,
today.
Our first
to the
show,
inaugural show.
Our maiden voyage. Clink, clink, clink.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mom and Dad.
What an honor.
I thought they were both dead, but they're in there somewhere. All right. Okay. So, Brian McNair is the executive director of World Central Kitchen, and that says nothing about a guy. You and I have never really had as much time to talk as we had before the show.
Right.
You're a Renaissance man. So before we talk about World Central Kitchen, I want to talk about you and how you got to where you are, because before this, you had a really brilliant career with DC Central Kitchen, which is as well globally famous. So talk a little about you.
How about that octopus hot dog?
Oh, today, yes. Brothers and sisters.
I saw an octopus on crutches. Do you think?
No.
No?
So at the Line Hotel, you have Eric Berner Yang's restaurant, Brothers and Sisters, which is open. It's the entire lobby. It's pretty fabulous. Yeah. And there is an octopus hot dog. So don't be afraid. It's gorgeous and delicious. It was really fabulous.
With Eric and Harper at the wheel.
Harper McClure, yes.
Can only win.
And an octopus's garden
in the
shade.
Okay, so let's just get a little bit of background on you.
Okay.
Okay, we know you're from New York originally.
New York, born and raised.
There we go. Westchester.
Actually, yeah, my family's from the Bronx originally, but we grew up in Dutchess County, actually, on the Hudson River.
Mm-hmm.
And I really miss that area when it's fall time, but I don't miss it now.
Yeah, I bet. So let's talk about, just quickly, you were cooking. You were doing some catering. But how did you get the hospitality gene along with your charitable gene? How did those two things combine?
You know, my dad was a musician, and he played in a band my whole childhood. So I was always drawn to music and a musician myself. So actually, I went to school for music and sound recording and in communications. And in the end, I actually moved to Manhattan and I went right into the music business, which was wild and crazy. And I worked with LL Cool J and Run DMC and the Fat Boys when rap was like just starting.
I feel like you're just bragging now.
Very
it just
well.
Sounds like he's bragging.
No, because I left very quickly.
Okay.
No, it was kind of, you know, it's just it's a very intense business, but I had... met some friends from school that were working in nonprofit arts, and that's how I got into development. And I started working in fundraising and the and marketing behind the nonprofit arts in New York. And you know, during that time, and way before that, actually, I've always loved cooking. I remember being 6 years old making gnocchi with my grandmother, and ever since then, I've always, you know.
Yeah, McNair sounds really Italian.
Yeah, you know, the other side is passarelli and rapoli.
Passarelli. Benissimo.
So, yeah, you know, in working in the nonprofit sector, I continued to cook. And then I landed a job with Outward Bound, where I managed their nonprofit events and the individuals' campaign. And most of the people on the board were, you know, high net worth individuals with penthouses.
That's my favorite kind of individual,
yeah,
by
too.
The way.
Right, me too.
And you know, they were on Madison Avenue, and they knew I cooked, and they started asking me to cater. So I started catering on the side while I was doing the nonprofit sector and really learning, you know, honing my skills in development and marketing. And so I had a probably good 10 years in working in nonprofit and development. And the catering just took over. I just got so busy with catering, and I was going to New York restaurant school, and I just
But then
went
suddenly,
yeah,
but I guess for family reasons, you're down here.
Yeah, how'd you wind up with Robert Egger?
So I'm cooking in New York, and my mother gets ill down here in D.C. She moved down to be closer to her grandkids who are here in Alexandria.
Mm-hmm.
And I transferred. I was working with the Hilton in New York, and I transferred to the Hilton in Alexandria, and I was cooking there, King Street Hilton, and I really missed the nonprofit sector. You know, I just really working with Outward Bound and working with people and watching their lives change. And
so at the core, you're an altruist.
Yeah, I love cooking, but I just missed really working with
people. So what brought you to DC Central Kitchen?
I needed to get involved in the nonprofit sector.
So for people who aren't familiar with DC Central Kitchen, explain its platform when you started with it.
Well, I went around. I worked at Martha's Table. I worked at a couple other places. Mm-hmm. But first day at DC Central Kitchen, when I walked into an industrial kitchen and there were men and women who have changed their lives from substance abuse or out of prison, and they were running a kitchen and producing 5,000 meals a day, you know, you do that, you volunteer there once or twice, and you're hooked.
So well, can we do a backstory,
just
really, on Robert? Robert Egger was a local, he was a club manager, a guy I met in the late 80s. And he got tired of seeing two things, food get thrown in the dumpster every night,
right,
and hungry homeless people digging through the dumpster. He mm-hmm. thought that was a shitty way to live. And DC Central Kitchen was born out of this. I mean, the guy's a hero.
Yeah.
And born out of this, and he put together this thing to collect. I'm doing it for you, but essentially you can take it over to collect unused, uneaten food that restaurants and clubs were going to throw out. And he started feeding people and training people.
But right. then did the mission change? Because did they continue collecting food at DC Central
Kitchen?
I feel like that got lost.
No, in the beginning, it's funny that people are talking about and writing books about food waste now.
Right.
Robert's been talking about it for 30 years.
Right, he was ahead of the curve.
And, at first the food that could be collected was food that was prepared. But that's dangerous. There's a lot of things that you can't take from, if it's been opened or semi-served, you can't really utilize that food. What happened is DC Central Kitchen started getting so large that Robert started talking to the purveyors, started talking to the vendors,
mm-hmm.
started talking to the hotels and restaurants. Look in your walk-ins, look in your freezers. What are there? What do you have that you're not going to use or that's a better tax write-off is probably a better way for you to utilize it.
Than throwing it in the garbage.
Right. And donate the bulk to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where the donations started coming in. They still collect quite a bit. When I was working there, we actually came up with, we actually went out to the Shenandoah Valley, where we heard that the Mennonite community was wasting or plowing back into the ground.
So gleaning.
Half of their product because it wasn't.
It wasn't pretty.
The coal. It wasn't the beautiful thing for the Whole Foods. So they were using the coals or the bees,
mm-hmm.
and they were plowing them back in. And Mike Curtin, CEO at the time, and I went down there and said, we're coming back with a couple trucks next week, and we're going to buy them from you
uh-huh.
at a good price. It's good for you. It's good for us.
Right.
And we brought more fresh veg into D.C.
Well, so gleaning is a huge issue across the country right now because that's been happening across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And again, D.C. Central Kitchen was ahead of the game
yeah.
on making that happen. Now, is that program still happening with D.C. Central Kitchen?
It is. As a matter of fact, we I think they've increased the amount of trucks that they use.
Mm-hmm.
And increase the amount of produce. What happened is it shined a light on the fact that we were bringing fresh produce literally from 2 hours outside of D.C. into our kettle meals, the meals that go to the shelters. And we got our first food service contract with Washington Jesuit Academy.
Mm-hmm.
This is all around the time when everyone's trying to improve the school food that kids are eating, and eventually led to a DC public schools contract, which they still have to this day.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And again, let's talk about the clientele that you bring in, the people who are trained at DC Central Kitchen, because that was a separate component. First, it was just feeding people, but then it was, let's give them a job.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most amazing things is as you deliver food to halfway houses, transitional homes,
mm-hmm.
shelters, men and women out of prison. I always say we delivered the food with the message. When you are ready to change your life, we have an opportunity for you. We have a training program.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert has always done it since the beginning, but it just grew and grew and grew stronger.
Yeah, but the thing that made the program so unique is that you not only train them, you help them find a job. Because if I'm trained, then it's even more frustrating if I'm still out on the street.
Well, I think that's a perfect segue. So how did DC Central Kitchen...
Of course it's a perfect segue.
Yes, you set it up. Thank
Master
you. Thank you,
of
darling.
Perfect segues is here.
Thank you. So how did DC Central Kitchen become... Like, one of the big things about DC Central Kitchen is that it partnered with chefs.
Right.
Which at the time was very brand new to bring chefs into the equation. So how did that start?
Well, we had to get jobs for people. So the way to do that was not just to prepare them for the interview and prepare their resume, but to bring chefs into the kitchen to start to see who we were training and to see that there were people that really wanted to learn and really wanted jobs. And, you know, that started the whole relationship with the chef with DC Central Kitchen.
So when did Jose get involved?
Jose was the chair before I was there. So
he was involved.
Robert Egger asked him to be the chairman early on. And then he's been chair emeritus ever since. And Jose and I became good friends when we started an event together called Capital Food Fight, which is now their biggest event of the year. And Jose and I said, we need to do something different, which at that time there were no.
Right, now there's a food event every other day.
I'm going to jump in for a minute because there may be someone out there living under a rock who has no idea.
With the Capital Food
Fight. Capital Food Fight.
What?
To whom we're referring. Jose Andres.
Let's
talk about him. I met him in 1990, I think, four, right when he came to the U.S., because Cafe Atlantico was owned by one of my business partners, David Abramson, and Jose was this shy, unassuming, and I don't think he was an executive
chef
at that point.
Can you imagine Jose being shy?
I know. He took an outgoing pill, but I think he was a sous chef. I don't even think he was an executive chef, but he was this nice, shy guy. And now he's the master of the food universe. Why don't you, if you don't mind, give us the 5 minutes on Jose.
Well, you know, he and I had met, and I was the liaison with him to build this event, Capital Food Fight. And, you know, he and his team have built restaurants not only here in D.C., but in hotels. Miami, Vegas. He's in Mexico City today.
Doesn't he still have the number one TV show in Spain,
Made in Spain.
Anyways, so, I mean, he's become a Latino Oprah.
He is.
Speaking of Oprah.
So he's, you know, he and his company have a number of restaurants and concepts, including beefsteak. But the thing that I know about Jose, and the way I know him the most, is that he genuinely wants to use food, use the power of food to change the world. And he's always been that way.
So how did you both go from working with DC Central Kitchen and doing the huge food fight event, and where did World Central Kitchen come from?
So Jose and I built Capital Food Fight for DC Central Kitchen, and it grew, and I was there for 10 years at DC Central Kitchen as the development officer, but also starting these new programs. And then one day Jose and Robert come to me. Oh no, I'm sorry. One day Jose walks into DC Central Kitchen and asks Robert and I into Robert's office and says, "Hey guys, I got back from Haiti. I really want to I'm doing some projects there. I'm really trying to help people cook cleaner and look at health." And
was this after an earthquake?
Right after the earthquake.
Okay.
And I want to do, and I'm looking for an organization to be part of that's like DC Central Kitchen, empowerment, not just handouts, just empowering people. But I don't see it. So I want to start my own, and I want to call it World Central Kitchen, tipping my hat to DC Central Kitchen.
That's so nice.
And Robert and I were like, "Yeah, go ahead, have fun." You know, a year later.
Good luck with that. Talk to you later.
Because he has so many projects.
Right.
And then a year later, he and Robert came to me and said, "Listen," and I'm still at DC Central Kitchen, but at this point I had a staff of 6 or 7 people. And Robert and Jose said, "Listen, we think it's time for you to come and help Jose run World Central Kitchen," because it was about a year old. And there was a lot of projects on the platform, but not a lot of direction.
Can I jump in for one second? If you're out there and you're hearing ambient noise, this studio is in the lobby. It's a glassed-in studio at the fabulous new Line Hotel, which is a great boutique hotel that just opened up in the Adams Morgan neighborhood in D.C. So you're hearing real life out there as people scuttle back and forth. Now, Brian.
So what was listen. World Central Kitchen and Jose has been in the news a lot recently, but I really want to start at the beginning. What was the initial mission? What was it, 5 years ago? Seven years ago, five years ago?
6 years ago on paper, and I've been there for five, six.
Okay. So what was the original mission of World Central Kitchen?
Well, it's always been empowering communities, strengthening economies.
Okay.
That's what we say. Mm-hmm. When I came in, I put a little spin on it and said smart solutions to hunger and poverty, because we're looking for smarter ways to go about it.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of right off the bat, we said, hey, how are we going to be unique? Well, very clearly, we're an NGO of chefs. So we started the Chef Network. We've got about 150 chefs in our Chef Network, ready, willing, and able to do something with us.
And what does that mean? Like, explain, don't talk about now, but like, explain initially, like, how you use chefs and where you took them. And I'd love to talk about some of the projects that you guys did before we're here, before now, because you have so many things in play right now.
Yeah, I think the biggest focus was Clean Cook Stoves, because Jose is the culinary ambassador for the Global Alliance.
Those are like those solar cook stoves,
right?
Well,
you know, it's not just that. It's the Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves focuses, it's part of the UN Nation, mm-hmm. UN Foundation. They focus on cleaner cooking around the world.
Okay. And what does that mean?
And that means that in Guatemala, in India, in Haiti, in many other countries, people are cooking with charcoal or some kind of hard wood or charcoal, quite often inside, inhaling it. And the stat is that 4 million people die a year from results of cooking with hard charcoal, hard wood inside. Children on the backs of of moms and immediately have asthma and affects their eyes. And, you know, so there's so many effects, not just on the person. From there, you have deforestation issues because there's so much charcoal being created and wood being
Well, you have the
down.
Pollution issue, too, as that stuff goes out there in the world.
I mean, it keeps going. And with deforestation, you have issues that affect the fish. You have issues that affect
everything. Right.
So that was the biggest focus in the beginning. And we started converting schools, and particularly Port-au-Prince, school kitchens that were cooking with charcoal. We would go in and clean them and do food safety sanitation training and mm-hmm. have them cook with LPG, so gas in the city.
Okay.
Because they had access to gas.
Mm-hmm.
In rural areas, they didn't have access to gas, so we're using what they call improved cook stoves.
Okay, what does that mean?
And the Global Alliance were spurred a couple years of inventions. You know, people all over the world were creating these really interesting stoves that may have some kind of funnel somewhere, but basically in the end, they use 60% less charcoal and they emit 70% less smoke.
And were you able to provide enough of these to create a difference? And is that still part of your model now?
Still part of our model. We have two big projects in Haiti. One's called Haiti Breathes, and that is converting school kitchens to cleaner cooking with food safety sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Food for Thought. And everything we do, we look at through the eyes of a chef. How can a chef help education? And we know education is one of the biggest issues and the biggest ways for developing countries to advance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how can we do that? Well, food or kitchens. So we actually partner with some of the agencies like World Food Program and so on that might be delivering food to certain areas. And I'm talking about Nicaragua, Dominican Republic, Zambia, Haiti. But we go in and build a very clean, stable kitchen and do food safety sanitation.
So you're saying they're just dropping it off? Or out of planes, but not showing anybody how to...
And sometimes not dropping it off because there's no kitchen there.
Right.
So if in a rural area, we can build 10 kitchens a year, which we're doing now with one of our partners, Cesal, out of Spain, for the next 5 years, we're building 10 kitchens a year in an area where there's very little, there's no, almost no kitchens, and the schools are in bad shape, and kids pretty much make a choice between collecting wood and water or going to school.
All right, well, let me ask you something, because you still are pursuing that peaceful mission, and it's a process, and there's no chaos. But you guys got into the chaos business when a hurricane hit about, what, 2010?
We did some hurricane relief in Hurricane Matthew in Haiti, because we were in Haiti already. And then soon after that, Houston, and as...
Right, well, I was going to say, suddenly the poo hit the fan,
Let's talk about the original hurricane relief. So, like, when the hurricane originally hit,
You know what? We're being asked to take a break. We're going to be right back. Sounds we're going good. To take it. We got to pay for the show.
Yes.
So we're going to take a commercial break, and we'll be back with Brian McNair and talk more about.
This is David and Nikki Nellis. We're Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. We'll be back in just a sec.
Right on.
And this relaxing break music today is courtesy of Flash Frequency. The song is called Sunrise from the record Shadow Fox. You can find him at flashfrequency.bandcamp.com. He also has a show here on Thursdays called Leaf Broadcast. This is Full Service Radio. We'll be right back with Industry Night.
We're back on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David, Nikki Nellis. Before we go back to talking to Brian about World Central Kitchen, Chris Houck is here. Chris is the...
and
what
Jeffrey.
Are you? You're the poor, Chris and Jeffrey's here. Yeah, these guys are with Moet Hennessy. And Chris, you're going to pour something different.
That's correct. We
started
out
Daddy with... needs a different kind of champagne. What do you got?
Well, Mommy's very happy with this champagne, I just want to say.
I think Mommy likes champagne. Daddy likes the Daddy champagne likes, of beers.
Actually... Truth be told, Daddy likes Mommy, but that's a whole other show. This is a family show.
Well, we did start off with Moet Imperial, and what we have next is Moet's Grand Vintage 2008 Rosé.
Okay. Right. So let's talk about the grapes in Rosé.
Jeffrey Barrientos is the world-class champagne opener.
Yes, he
Didn't shoot the cork up anybody's nose, nothing. It was nice.
So talk about... you know, rosé, a flat rosé right now is so hot. Like, everybody's drinking it all summer. Tell us about rosé champagne.
Rosé champagne is simply champagne that has a little bit of still red wine added, either Meunier or Pinot Noir, into the blend before it goes into secondary fermentation in the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
That's rosé champagne.
That's it? It's just a little bit?
Yep, it's champagne that's had red wine added.
Okay, but so it's not even skin contact or anything like that?
No, you make a separate... red wine, and then you blend that in until it's ready to go.
The color you want it?
That's the color, the fruit, the body, a little bit more tannins, because it is obviously made with red wine.
Okay. So let's talk about this specific Moet, because it's the 2008, and there's something special about that?
It's delicious.
Okay.
Extremely
delicious. You don't
delicious.
Have to say that twice. I get that.
Chris, what's he going to say? This is swill. No.
Only the best for you, David.
No, but it has a special bottle.
It is vintage Moet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, every year champagne houses put out their non-vintage, and in exceptional years in terms of character, champagne houses will release a vintage year. This is 2008, which was absolutely an amazing vintage. Mm-hmm. Everything I've tasted from 2008 has been really, really tasty.
For champagnes across the board or rosé specific?
Just champagnes across the board. It was a great year.
I think I still had hair in 2008.
You might have.
I remember 2008.
Actually, I think 2008 was a really good year.
The last year, the last hair fell in 2008. And so did the economy.
All right.
So non-vintage champagne is pretty much the house recipe that doesn't vary in terms of flavor profile every single year. Vintage champagne is something that changes drastically year to year, depends upon what the weather was like that year. So you have the 2008 Grand Vintage Moet, this rosé. This is 46% Pinot Noir, 32% Meunier, and 22% Chardonnay.
It's a beautiful
Now,
color.
Of this wine, you have 20% of this wine, of the Pinot Noir, is still red Pinot Noir.
Okay, cool.
So all aged right. in the cellars for about 7 years, and the dosage is very, very low.
Oh, the dosage again with
the
that.
Dosage. The dosage. I had to bring it back.
Well, we all get schlunkered, let's go back to Brian. So, Brian, I'm going to sort of speed it up to the point where we, I mean, here you are helping to feed and educate and nurture people, not just their bodies, but their spirits, and giving them opportunities for mm-hmm. the future. And then, you know, and we're on the internet, so we can say it, the shit hits the fan, and there's a huge hurricane that devastates Haiti, and Jose says, we got to feed people, essentially, right?
No, I think it was Brian who said we got to
feed people. Was it Brian?
Well,
Come on, take the credit.
I took Jose to Hurricane Matthew in Haiti. Because we have great relationships with a bunch of chefs there. And they said, hey, listen, we have a food truck. We're going to take the culinary students from our culinary school.
In Haiti.
In Haiti.
When you're talking about the chefs there, you're talking about the chefs in Haiti. Right? Okay.
And they said, we have a food truck. If you can help us fundraise money for the food, we'll use your students, your culinary students at our culinary school as volunteers. So we did that. Jose went out there. We fed for a little bit. And Jose had been talking about doing emergency food relief for a while, so this was our first intro to it.
So talk about the fundraising part, because that it sounds so like, oh, we raised some funds, and then we fed, you know, 20,000 people every day or whatever. But it's not like he just picked up the phone and called Spielberg and Gates and said, hey, each of you send me $10 million.
Well, remember, we're talking about
I'd like to do
Hurricane
that.
Matthew now. So mm-hmm. we only raised online $30,000-$40,000 over a month or so,
mm-hmm.
just enough to feed maybe 500 to 1,000 meals a day for the people in that area.
Over how many days? I mean,
that was about a month, maybe two months. We raised enough money to feed people about 500 meals for 2 months. Okay.
And so after that moment, was there a light bulb for everybody? Like, yeah, this is something we can do.
Yeah, I think, you know, it had been something Jose had been talking about for a while. And, you know, Jose's ideas are not small. So he would, his ideas, aircraft carrier.
Let's plant corn on the moon.
Let's take over an aircraft carrier and feed the world, you know. But
right.
So this was the start. And we came home and continued our culinary school work, continued our clean kitchen work, school kitchen work. And then Houston.
Well, so let's talk about Houston, because I feel like it is, not that it shouldn't be, but it's a little overshadowed by Puerto Rico. But did he just get on, if you were following him on social media, which I was, it looked like Jose literally just got on a plane and landed in Dallas and went to the grocery store and bought a bunch of food and decided to cook it up and said to other chefs, come join me.
By himself.
Right, by himself.
So he and I were talking the night before, and he said, we really should go down there and help. I said, okay, well, let me know what we're going to do. The next morning I woke up and there's a picture of Jose on a plane. He texts me and he says, I'm on my way to Houston. He's on an airplane. He didn't even tell me he was going.
Right.
So he literally was there by himself, rented a car. I think had trouble even finding a place to stay for the first day or two.
Mm-hmm.
And then Victor Albizu came down with us and a couple other people, and we went down. There was a system in place, you know, that we were at the convention center for a while. We also worked with a hospital preparing maybe a couple thousand meals a day. The best thing we did for Houston was to mobilize almost 1 million pounds of food. So there's different things we can do in different situations.
How?
Yeah, what is that? I mean, explain what that means.
Well, I mean, is that from the FEMA and those guys, or is
no,
it from
that's
private
from
that's sources?
For, private sources, think food group relationships. Javier Garcia is on my board, has relationships with some other larger organizations. And we reached out to everyone. And we said,
are we talking about, I mean, we don't have to name names, but are we talking about like big food delivery services?
Yes.
Okay.
Food delivery, food manufacturer. Like we're delivering, 50 pallets of crushed tomatoes in can, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we started getting all of that. Even some folks delivered prepared food from California. I mean, Bon Appetit and Wolfgang Puck and some of those groups. But in the end, we also ended up partnering with a restaurant called The Reef. And Brian Callahan. I hope that's his last name. Anyway,
we're going to double check that.
The chef there is
he's
awesome.
He's listening. Okay. It's the internet.
Sorry, chef.
Don't screw it up.
The chef is awesome there, and they ended up becoming a hub for feeding all of the area of Houston because their restaurant was damaged a bit, and they said, okay, we're down anyway.
Right.
So we ended up having food delivered there. They had a couple refrigerator trucks out in back and had volunteers, and they would prepare thousands of meals and deliver them all over to the areas.
Did you already have a system and you're like, we're going to help you, or he had a system? Like, how did that happen?
When we first came, we started cooking for a couple of days in the convention center with our chefs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved to a hospital and started cooking there for a couple of days.
And people would just queue up and get meals, or they'd hear
about
it?
Yeah, there was so many organizations that were willing to come pick up and deliver.
Got it.
And
so you were getting paper plates and plastic and utensils donated and all that stuff.
Yeah, all
too.
That stuff. But wow. The convention center had a system, and then they were using their own kitchens, and then I believe they brought in Salvation Army in the end, or was it Red Cross? I forget. Anyway, somebody came in and started taking over the system at the convention center.
Mm-hmm.
But there were still areas outside of Houston proper that really got hit by the flood the most, and they needed food delivered to them. 1,000 mm-hmm. meals here, 1,000 meals there. And the Reef restaurant was the one who really took the initiative to do that. So what we could do at that point was get food to them. So we mobilized food, and we mobilized financial donations online for their delivery, for whatever they needed, and that's what we helped them with.
Well, I got a question. Let me just jump in for a sec, because, and you may not want to answer this, but the word on the street was that you guys were delivering, and we should get to Puerto Rico too, you were able to get food, prepare food, and deliver food more efficiently and more broadly than FEMA.
That was number three. That was Puerto Rico.
Right. That's incorrect.
And not more than FEMA, because FEMA doesn't feed people.
Well, they give the money to
FEMA distributes the funds to organizations that will feed.
Which is important for people to understand.
Yeah,
you know, because FEMA is just this sort of like broad umbrella, but people don't understand how it works. You know, so like when people are complaining about FEMA, you have to really understand what they're complaining about, or if they don't know what they're complaining about. Do you know what I mean? Like
they're feeding people.
Right.
What do we do as a federal agency to help this particular emergency situation, and every one of them is different.
Right. So, okay, you're barely recuperated from Harvey, and Maria hits Puerto Rico.
Right.
And so what's the decision process? Where does everybody get going? Like, are you like, yes, this is what we are doing now. We are in it. We're going to go. Like, how did you motivate so fast?
The trick is we're a very small organization. I mean, literally 3 or 4 people in mm-hmm. D.C.
Which is amazing.
And I have a few part-time people that work in Haiti. I was already in Haiti.
Okay.
And building a culinary school was our biggest project this year. And we raised...
Until.
We raised a big amount of money to renovate a building and get all this beautiful kitchen designed for culinary school to create jobs in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And it was happening at the same time. Literally, our equipment was amassed on the border of DR Haiti. coming across, but so as soon as it happened, Jose went down again with Nate Mook, who's a friend of ours, who Nate pretty much our videographer. I mean, he owns his own company. He's a fantastic video guy who has become a great operations guy on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And within a couple days, they had met chefs and set up a system where they were preparing hot meals inside the kitchen of a restaurant, sandwiches in the cold area of the restaurant, had 5 food trucks that were preparing their own type of food every day, and outdoor paella system in a parking lot. So when I arrived 5 days later, there's Jose orchestrating all of this going on, 5,000 meals a day.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit. First, unlike being on the mainland where you have access to volunteers, where are these volunteers coming from on Puerto Rico?
You have plenty of access. You have to remember that everyone at this point is out of work.
Right.
Especially chefs.
Mm-hmm.
So the number, when we started getting big press and the number of people that wanted to volunteer and fly down to Puerto Rico, and I'm going, it was unfortunate that, you know, quite frankly, we can't accommodate you as a volunteer. Some people we could as it got a little bit lighter, but it's smarter for us to hire some of the chefs that are out of work and put them to work.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly. I think your challenge was more about getting foodstuffs.
Getting product.
Getting utensils and paper.
Believe it or not, the product was there. So the big distributors of food product, like Jose Santiago is a big distributor of food product. Caribbean Produce, some of the bread companies, they had generators. So they kept their refrigeration running. So we started purchasing from them, and we negotiated with them and so on. But we purchased food, an astronomical amount of food. I mean, the invoices that my staff in D.C. were wiring money to every day was more than we did in an entire year sometimes, you know.
So I guess that brings us to the next question. How did that fundraising, I mean, you had to do some massive fundraising very right. quickly in order to take care of this mission.
I think we were concerned a little bit in the beginning. We had a lot of attention on us. We were doing 5,000 meals, and Jose wanted to do 100,000 meals a day.
Just a little kick up.
Yeah, a little kick up. But there were places to do it, and he had a good strategy. We found a partner who had a trade school, an organization from Spain that runs a trade school, who had literally 12 trade schools, all with kitchens all around the island. And six of them at that point were functional on generators. Mm-hmm. So we partnered with them to get food delivered to them. And they use their students as part of their curriculum to churn out anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000 meals a day. So we started feeding the island because we found kitchens and we got food to those kitchens.
Well, I want to go back to, and I'm not trying to pound on the government. I'm trying to understand, did the government also try and get MREs, meals ready to eat and all that to Puerto Rico? I mean, because they're, I don't even know, what is the population of the island? 2 million?
I don't know.
3
I can't
million? It's
that.
About 3
right.
million, isn't
no,
it?
I think it's 3 or 4 million.
Right. Okay. So that's a ton of people to feed. So who else and how else was involved in the in, you know, in the food distribution?
Well, I know that there were MREs, and MREs are very expensive, but I also.
And not delicious.
Yeah. But we also know that there were some barges filled with water and produce and food.
That couldn't get in,
no,
right?
No,
initially?
They were there.
But they got into San Juan, and we're talking about the interior.
There you go. There's
yeah,
where
get
the
up
problem
in the mountains.
Was. How do you get the food distributed
right.
from San Juan up into the mountains?
Right.
And so, but you guys took some of that over.
Yeah, we did.
World Central Kitchen.
Would you have choppers or trucks?
We ended the roads up were hiring our food truck friends to not produce food, but to deliver. And also another company who basically started one of these food delivery systems, and they had a series of trucks. We hired them. So we were putting people to work. I mean, we weren't...
But weren't the roads crap, too? I mean...
Yeah, the roads were, and eventually they've, as they, the more and more they got repaired, the further out we could go. Today, we're still, right now, I just
You're
got,
still in Puerto Rico.
We're still there. I got a picture today from Vieques, which is the island that
yeah.
I know.
We've been serving meals on since the beginning.
Because they got flattened, right?
They got flattened, and the kitchen we're using, part of our continuing support is not only meals, but startup grants for some of the kitchens that got hit. For some of the food trucks that helped us that really got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And Vieques got a small startup grant from us, and they actually sent me pictures of their renovations today.
That's so exciting.
So we're long-term in this.
Okay, so now that your mission has drastically, not that these other components, you know, you have all these other things in play, but now you have a whole new mission. So
right.
how does this change... Your focus, Jose's focus, the people of World Central Kitchen. How does this change your next steps? Because you have to be prepared for that next disaster. It's
yeah.
coming.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, in the end, the fundraising came through.
I mean, just for the record, I've been asking good questions the entire show. But
yeah.
go ahead.
Yeah,
I
like
God.
To say that.
You know who you sound like? Donald Trump. I'm like smart. I'm a regular genius.
Okay, anyway,
so
go
at
ahead.
First
it's like Curly. I'm trying to think, but nothing's happening.
At first, there was panic about the funding, and the funding came through.
Okay.
The more, you know, we did end up negotiating a contract with FEMA for a certain amount of time, and they paid us to do 120,000 meals a day for a couple
weeks. Were you apprehensive initially doing contracts like that?
Of course. And I think there were some people there to help us navigate through that, which was very helpful. And then the press was so good that some anonymous donors came through with some big funding.
We love anonymous donors.
You know, and this really allowed us. This really allowed us to do what we really needed to do: is feed the entire island for as long as we can. And now we have a reserve that's going to go help support some longer term projects, including some agricultural projects,
like
working with Mercy Corps and JPHRO to restore the land and seeds and training for farmers in probably a good 10 different areas that got wiped out.
In
Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico specific.
Yeah. Yeah.
But let's talk about now, you're still in Puerto Rico, but I want to, because believe it or not, we only have 10 minutes left of the show. So let's talk about now World Central Kitchen, because you have two big fundraising events that you do every year. And that whole thing changes drastically, right?
Yeah, well, the thing is, I've been looking for my program director, kind of assistant, for about a year or so. But I'm really cautious on the match. Is the match the international development person who brings way too much baggage with them because we like to do things differently?
Brian, I'm sitting right across from you, for God's sake. But I would not call Nikki baggage. That's not very nice.
Or is it a chef that wants to change their career? You know, so there's a couple options there.
Well, can we talk about your chef partnerships? Because like you mentioned earlier that you brought Vic Elvisu.
Yeah, we do a lot together.
Right, but you do stuff with Eric Bruner Yang. You do, you bring chefs along. Mm-hmm. But what does that mean for them, and what does that mean for you? What does it mean when Vic goes with you or Eric goes with you to Cambodia? I mean, what does it mean? What do they provide?
Well, there's a couple things. There's a couple chefs that work here who help us develop curriculum for our culinary school, and then maybe come down and do some guest chef days, demo, and then observe and help us bring it to the next level. The majority of what our chefs have been doing have been what we call sink to stove, and that is a food safety sanitation program where we train school cooks or moms or whoever the partner is on the ground in the basics of food safety and sanitation in your cooking. Cook a big meal. We did it in Cambodia with Eric. Victor and I did it in Lima. We did it in Nicaragua twice. So a lot of the chefs have been able to help us in the food safety sanitation program or curriculum development. But now they can come, and the perfect example is Victor helped in Houston. But now we have these opportunities for chefs to come and help feed the world.
So do you feel that, given what you've done in Puerto Rico and in Houston and also in California, because you went out to California with the wildfires too, right? You have a system in play. Like, you know how to roll it out.
We learned a lot from it, and now it's a matter of hiring some of the right people to kind of run both what we call the Chef Relief Network. So we have this Chef Network, but there's Emergency Food Relief, which is bigger than anything we've done. So, I mean, Jose is heavily involved in that and its growth and where we go from here. But doing the recap and figuring out how we need to be ready and having a person
and
run that.
How much of the fundraising that supports all that is coming from big ticket donors versus just folks who go online and say, you guys are great, I want to help?
You know, it's really been amazing. It's something we didn't even expect. I mean, there was a few $1 million donors who came through, which will help us build this Chef Relief Network. And then there were thousands of people who gave $50.
Great.
Well, I think what's
sound like Bernie.
Well, I think what's really important is telling everybody how they can help with World Central Kitchen. You know, if you're not a chef, but you want to volunteer or participate or send money, how do people get involved with World Central Kitchen?
Well, the volunteer piece is difficult now, but if there's anything, you know, now we're talking about disaster relief, right? So it's like, well, when the next disaster comes, you can help.
Give us a call.
But we kind of hope that doesn't happen. But we all know climate change is...
It will happen.
...is just, you know, it's just causing a lot of effects. Drastic weather. But they can go online. They can come to Dine and Dash, which is our big fundraising event every year in June. Mm-hmm. We close down 30 restaurants. Come eat, drink, get all of them, and help us fundraise. A fundraise online. World Food Day is another big thing that we do. And just keep posted, because there'll be opportunities for people to get involved.
Excellent.
All right. Grow. Can you give your web address so that people can find you?
So it's worldcentralkitchen.org.
How hard can that be to
and
spell?
And on all their social media, it's WC Kitchen.
At WC Kitchen.
Right.
All right, Brian, thanks
Brian.
So much.
Brian McNair.
Let's go back to Jeffrey and Chris for a last bit of chatter.
Right. Both of
about
you.
The bubbles. Both of you. Look
what
at you. Who wants to talk first? What else do you want us to know?
Yes.
Well, I wanted to talk about Brian very quickly. There was some great volunteers from Think Food Group that came down and and helped him, and were like great sous chefs, even front of the house people, friends of mine that donated a lot of volunteered.
Sure did.
Right. So. Well, I mean, it's a very the DC community is super generous, and the chef community in general, especially in the United States, is ridiculously generous to one another, don't you think?
Yeah, and in Puerto Rico in particular, I mean, we had a really great group of chefs, and as he said, front of house folks from TFG, from Bon Appetit, that came down immediately and helped.
It's amazing. All right, well, we are going to finish up. We do want to talk a little more about champagne and bubbly, and we're talking about Moët. And you guys brought in Moët today because it's very special to the both of you. And I think people, first of all, a lot of people call it Moët instead of Moët. So why do people make that mistake?
Well, because they're stupid.
No one is stupid.
They don't speak French.
They must be pretty smart if they're enjoying champagne.
At least they're
champagne.
Trying to order it, right?
Right, exactly. No, we love all of our guests and clientele that love our champagnes.
I called it Moët for years because I thought it sounded more French.
Well, it has a Dutch origin.
What a maroon. Anyways.
David, you're fine.
Yeah.
But no, it's very special to us. It's the number one selling champagne brand in the entire world, except for in the United States.
Really? Why do you think that is?
Well, because Veuve Clicquot is the number one United States.
Because it's got unaided brand awareness. People know the name. They go in, they ask
but
for
I feel like everybody
Veuve
knows
or Veuve or
Moët. I just did it.
You know why? Because the guy's name was Monet. So why isn't it Moët?
Oh, I know why.
Why?
But here, Jeffrey.
Because the N?
No, because it's Moët and Chandon. So it's like a, right? Because of the and?
No, I mean, it's a, I guess, a phonetical.
A phonetical?
Yes, precisely. But yeah, you know, Chris and I, our agenda or our most important thing for our New Year's resolution is to increase the awareness of Moët de Chandon in the D.C. area, Maryland for me as well. So, you know, we love the wines, you know, the focus is on the liveliness of the wine and the freshness of the fruit and, you know, how easily it pairs in the range that there is. You know, the wines are so versatile and there's a long range. And
well, can we talk about the different offerings of Moët? Because there's several. And, you know,
for the
uninitiated, it can be a little confusing.
Sure. So, you know, we have the Brut Imperial and the Rosé Imperial. Those are the village or the entry level wines of Moët at Chandon. Mm-hmm. And then we have the Grand Vintage, which comes in Brut and Rosé, which are great. And, you know,
for people who don't know what Brut is, can you explain that quickly?
A blend of, again, the grape varietals that comes in a white, wine with no skin contact or blending of red wine. But I do want to say about the Rosé very quickly. It's Rosé Champagne is expensive and highly priced for a reason, because it is rare and very difficult to produce. I'll let Chris.
Well, that's why we have you guys on the show,
right?
So we can get some.
Well,
free. Free's good.
What makes it Brut is the dosage.
Oh, again, back to the dosage.
Such, Chris, you know, you're just a snot. You know that, Chris?
My sister still to this day thinks so. But the certain levels of dosage that one needs to remember are 0 to 3, 3 to 7, 3 to 6, 6 to 12. 6 to 12 is Brut.
Okay.
So, and then above that, you don't run into too many different types of champagne until you hit demi-sec.
That's what I was going to suggest.
Yeah,
okay.
You have 32 to 50.
You
that's where most champagnes are either 32 to 50, demi-sec, or Brut, 6 to 12.
Okay. And what about, just quickly, we only have like a minute left. Where can people, like, do you suggest people ordering champagne, especially Moët, you know, with dinner or with hors d'oeuvres? Like, when, I mean, I drink it all the time, but when do you like to drink it?
Which is why I have no money, by the way.
Breakfast, lunch,
broke.
Yeah. Oh, I like it. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Are there probiotics in it? That's what I need to know. And actually, can we put some probiotics in here? Isn't there yeast? I mean, doesn't that mean something?
Does anybody have any insights into my life? They call it Foodie and the Beast, but it should be Foodie and the Broke Jumbo, because I ain't got no money.
Moët is actually organic.
Oh, so yes. Maybe there are some probiotics moving around in there.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it's very healthy when you drink it and then drive.
Moët and Chandon has led the charge in terms of sustainability in champagne, all sorts of innovative practices, from bringing stainless steel to champagne and using it as a fermentation method, because stainless steel is much easier to control fermentation than oak. It's a lot cleaner. So there's a ton of history, which we'll probably have to get into
Another time.
To come back.
We'll come back next week.
Well, we would love to have you guys back. We know you have more in your portfolio, so we can certainly bring you back to talk about something different next time.
We do have a lot of fun things.
And you're the portfolio specialist.
I've got it all.
Aren't you, Chris?
Well, we want to thank all of our guests for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're handing it off to me. Listen, this show is live every week, but you can also always go back and hear it on the full service radio podcast. Figure out what network you're on.
Right. Anyway, we are live at the Line Hotel. We have been talking about World Central Kitchen and Moët and Chandon. And we appreciate all of our guests today. Next week, we'll be talking about sexual harassment in the restaurant industry. I know that sounds really down, but we have Catherine Morris and Ruth Gresser coming on. It's going to be a great show. Join us then.
Play us out, Liberace.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.